Hi, it's Diane. On My Mind, legendary journalist Roger Mudd. He spent nearly 20 years covering politics in Washington for CBS News and later, briefly, took over as anchor at NBC. He made his mark with special reports on Watergate, the civil rights movement, and Vietnam, and with an interview with Edward Kennedy that ended the then senator's bid for the White House. Roger Mudd was my dear friend. He died earlier this month at age 93. In 2008, he joined me on the Diane Rehm Show to discuss his book, The Place to Be, Washington, CBS, and the Glory Days of Television News. I'm happy to bring that conversation to you today. I hope you enjoy listening to this as much as I did. Good morning to you, Roger Mudd. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
So glad to have you
here.
Well,
it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Roger, talk about, in general terms, what it was that made CBS the place to be.
It was a perfect storm. What came together were a cadre of very talented, well-educated, hardworking, ethical men and women, combined with a 20-year run of stories unlike any we'd ever had before, beginning with the election of John Kennedy and through his assassination, through the assassination of his brother, through the assassination of Martin Luther King, through the violence and chaos of Vietnam, the chaos of the civil rights movement, Watergate, the impeachment of Richard Nixon, the resignation of Richard Nixon, the brief, unhappy administration of Gerald Ford, and it all ended not with a whimper, but it ended ended with a bang.
And there were some really wonderful names that were part of that CBS bureau, people whose names we still know.
Well, I was hired by Howard K. Smith, and he was replaced by David Schoenbrunn as the bureau chief. But in that bureau, there was Daniel Shore, Dan Rather, George Herman, Bob Pierpoint, Marvin Kalb, Bob Schieffer, Barry Serafin, David Shoemaker, Bruce Morton, and there was Leslie Stahl and Connie Chung and Mariah McLaughlin and Bernard Shaw and Hal Walker, and the list goes on and on.
Boy, I'll bet those few women you mentioned had to work very, very hard to gain a foothold in that bureau, considering the power, the influence, and the fact that you all were men.
It was not an easy road, not an easy row to hoe for Leslie and Connie and Mariah, but they succeeded in a way that guaranteed that their careers would be respected. Leslie, of course, began as what she called a handmaiden to Daniel Shore during Watergate, and she was breaking stories herself. But the arrangement was that anything she came up with would have to be handed to Daniel Shore. That was the arrangement that Small had imposed because Leslie was just starting. And finally, she had broken so many of the stories herself that she went in to Mr. Small's office and blew her stack and said, "I'm tired of having to hand off all this stuff to Daniel Shore." And Small said, "Well, I wondered how long it would take you to blow your stack. From now on, you're on your own, and you will be the Watergate reporter for the morning news." And so she had her own place to be.
How intense was all the competition among not only the women and the men, but the men themselves?
It was intense. It was always under control.
But what does that mean?
Well, I mean that you didn't have face-to-face confrontations. The competition was such that you always admired someone who had done a good story. The competition came when one beat overlapped with another, and so you had a little poaching going on from time to time.
Give me an example.
Well, in the case of, for instance, when Dan Shore came, his assignment and he created it himself, and he was the only one in Washington at the time covering the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson. But the Great Society went into all sorts of fields, and Dan, rightly so, felt he had poaching rights anytime a Great Society story came up, whether it was in the Agriculture Department, the Justice Department, and so those men and women who were on those beats exclusively did not like him poaching. So that was a case of some irritation from time to time. But, you know, without Dan Shore in that bureau, we would have been a lesser bureau.
Roger, it took you a long time to write this book. I know there were many of your friends, colleagues, myself included, who urged you to write a book. Why has it taken you so long?
Well, I don't think it's taken me so long. What took me so long was to get to the point that I wanted to write it. People had been urging me since I had retired in 2004 to write. But the stars had to be aligned properly. So I began to write, but not with any narrative arc. I just a chapter here, a chapter here. And I sent it off to Peter Osnos, the publisher of the Public Affairs Press, with the help of Jim Lehrer. And Mr. Osnos said, I don't want to publish that. It's the chapter on NBC, which wasn't a happy experience. He said, the bitterness still comes through. But the people know that story. He said, people know what happened to network news. Why don't you write about when being a television newsman was an honorable profession? Write about that great bureau you were a part of. And it's eureka. So the next morning, I had the idea, and wow. I went and bought a little micro cassette recorder, and I began to track down all the men and women who had been in the bureau, and they were delighted.
How many people did you talk to?
55.
Wow.
And every time I would call them and tell them what I was doing, they were so thrilled, so happy, because that experience for them was as important as it was for me.
Except for Ed Bradley, with whom you talked shortly, a few months before he died. It was not a happy experience for him.
No, it was not, and he didn't make any secret of his unhappiness. And Bill Galbraith, the copy editor who ran the desk, the assignment editor is what I mean, not copy, the assignment editor, would send Ed up to the Hill with sort of vague instructions about just see what's going on. Mudd has to come in to do his evening piece, so you go up and look around. And Ed got that assignment so many times that he finally said, Bill, you better get another dude. Since that's something you didn't say to the assignment editor, get another dude. But it was obvious Ed did not like the routine of wandering around on the Hill. Mr. Small saw the problem, assigned him to one of the political campaigns, which he liked very much, on the road, on the air every night. But then when he came in to work in the White House, he was a desk man again and hated it. So anyway, the opportunity came to go to New York on 60 Minutes, and he took it, and he became, you know, a very, very fine, strong broadcaster.
He sure did. And his death at such an early age was, I think, a shock to all of us. Your relationship with Dan Rather early on was quite friendly and quite easy.
It was. We were both about the same age, had young families, both loved the South, and we took skiing trips together, and he had come to the Bureau maybe a year after I'd been there. So we were moving along. He came up to Washington after the assassination of Kennedy. He was the Texan who was going to cover the Texan. And Dan had a fairly rough year breaking in. President Johnson and the Texas people around him thought that they could co-opt him. And he's not a co-opable fellow. Dan is not. So the first year was not a good year for him, and he got a chance to go abroad. And he went to London and Vietnam. And when he came back, he was, I found, much different than I had remembered him 2 years before. So we were on parallel tracks. We were rivals. And I thought the rivalry on my part and his part got a little too intense.
Roger Mudd actually began his broadcasting career in radio. And there was a rather famous flub that occurred that you know, I just found so wonderfully refreshing as well as amusing. Tell us about it, Roger.
That would have been in Richmond, Virginia. I had started as a newspaper man, a summer replacement, and my fingers were too big to type. So anyway, I was not kept at the newspaper, but they said a radio station across the street needs a news director. So they hired me, and without very much instruction, they put me on the air. I was doing the 12 o'clock noon broadcast and was doing pretty well until I hit this item from Rome. The Pope Pius XII was seriously ill, and so I read the item and, to my horror, heard myself saying, "The condition of pipe poets has grown steadily worse, and they have summoned to the pipe's bedside the Italian doctor and two swish specialists." So on the desk is what's known as a cough box.
Of
with two little switches on it, and
yeah,
you hit one if you want to clear your throat. So I was new. I hit the wrong button, and so the audience down in Richmond for the next 2 or 3 minutes would hear bursts of insane laughter punctuated by dead silence. So that was my introduction to the wacky world of radio.
How long did they keep you on, Roger?
Well, I guess if it had been in Boston or Providence, Rhode Island, with a big Catholic population, I would have. But they didn't. They all sort of laughed about it and let it go.
And then from Richmond, Virginia Radio, you moved here to WTOP
right.
Radio.
Right.
And how long were you before television stepped
in? Well, I worked right across the street.
I know
WTOP
you did.
Radio was 40th and Brandywine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can see the building through your window.
Yes.
I was there from 56 to 61. And at that time, the CBS Bureau, the Network News Bureau, was in that building. So we were on the third floor and they were on the second. And I would see these great icons from CBS, you know, going home at night, coming in. There was Steve Cushing and there was Bill Shedell and Bill Downs and Nancy Honchman, Nancy Dickerson, and Howard K. Smith. And Howard K. Smith used to watch me on the 11 o'clock local news and offered to hire me. And so I went to work in 1961 at CBS for $19,000 a year.
$19,000 a year. When it came time for you to move to the networks, you became the substitute anchor for Walter Cronkite.
That was in the 70s that happened. Walter wanted to carve out a nice vacation, so part of his negotiations with his agent and CBS allowed him 2 months off every summer. And so I was his regular substitute. So I would, in effect, move to New York and had a little pad up there. And on weekends, and I was doing the Saturday news also. So it became part of the perceived wisdom that when Walter retired, or as Richard Salan said, if he ever gets hit by a truck, Roger Mudd will succeed him as anchor. But a lot of factors came into play, and so the time came to replace Walter. They chose Dan Rather for a lot of reasons. But that period in which I was the summer anchor gave me a good taste of what anchoring was like, and it was exhilarating. And you got a good table at every restaurant that you went to. But it also isn't like reporting at all, because you're not reporting. You're sort of saying stuff that others are giving you, and you don't have total control of what's said. You have to rely on very good producers and reporters. But because I, as you know, because I've told you before, that I'm the son of two perfectionists, my father and mother, and I became a perfectionist, and I hated being wrong. And as a consequence, I was a little difficult to work with in that way, because I was always asking questions and making sure that it was right. And I guess I got to be a pain in the neck for some people.
Before we get to the day of that confrontation, when you found out that you were not going to succeed Walter Cronkite, you made a very, very important speech, and one that the folks in New York took great umbrage at. Would you read that for us?
Sure. This was a speech at Washington and Lee University, my alma mater in Lexington, Virginia, 1970, December. It is now my belief that broadcasting in sound or vision will not prove to have contributed to the advancement of ideas or the education of man as much as the printed word. The inherent limitations of our media make it a powerful means of communication, but also a crude one, which tends to strike at the emotions rather than the intellect. For television journalists, this means a dangerous and increasing concentration on action, which is usually violent and bloody, rather than on thought. The bright hopes that we all had for television forever elude us. The industry somehow still is unable or unwilling now to move beyond its preoccupation with razzle-dazzle. Our broadcasts have not improved. If anything, the quality has declined. The tube has become a trip, a national opiate, a babysitter who charges nothing, something to iron by, to shave to, or doze over, and in the news departments of the networks, the first question the producer asks a reporter is not, "What's in it?" but "How long is it?" Then I go on to write, "The timing of those words could not have been worse. Vice President Agnew's denunciation of the media was still ringing in the ears of CBS management, and to them I had seemingly joined the enemy with my public denunciation of the profession that was paying me so handsomely. I thought my criticism was within the bounds of fair comment, and that CBS was a grown-up company and could handle it. How wrong, how naive I was."
What happened, Roger, after you gave that speech?
I got a note from Richard Salant, president of CBS News, saying, "The next time you're in New York, I would like to see you. I would like an explanation of why you persist in biting the hand that feeds you." So I wrote back to him and said, "Next time I'm in New York, I'd be delighted." And he said, no, not the next time. Come immediately." So I went up to New York and got kneecapped.
What does that mean?
That means that Salant had assembled a group of producers and reporters and so forth, and I was escorted in and had to defend this speech.
In front of a number of people.
15 or 20.
Okay.
And I got no support at all. Only Paul Greenberg, who was my producer, stood by me. And I was supposed to be eating lunch, but didn't have a bite to eat because it was not a happy experience to be slam dunked, as it were.
Pretty intense.
Yes. And I thought that was it. No. Mr. Salant wants to take you over to BlackRock, being the corporate headquarters. So in Salant's limousine, the two of us drove over crosstown to BlackRock. He never said a word.
In the car.
In the car. And then I was taken up to the 89th floor, or whichever floor it was, and was sat down, and I was cross-examined by Richard Jenks, who was then, I think, number three in the company. And that was better than the part with my colleagues, because I detected Mr. Jenks agreed with me, but he was afraid to say so under those circumstances. He told me later that he liked the speech. So then I went back to Washington, tail between the legs, and was taken out to lunch again by Bill Small, our bureau chief, and told very quietly, in a way that he always had, he told me that I would not any longer be substituting for Walter Cronkite, that they wanted to ice me for a while. So I got iced for about a year and a half, and then I resumed the substitution role.
You were continuing then to do your reporting here in Washington, covering the Congress,
right,
covering all the issues that you knew and could communicate so well, but no subbing for Walter Cronkite. Who filled in for you?
John Hart did, and he's a splendid broadcaster, and he was the fill-in.
How did that whole experience affect your outlook on CBS?
Well, it taught me, I think, in Bill Leonard's phrase, it taught me to hate up. It was difficult, and I knew because of that experience that New York really was not a place I wanted to go. There's so much internecine warfare. Talk about competition in Washington. The rivalry and the throat cutting in New York is much more intense. People rise and fall, quickly and just sort of vanish without any explanation. So I didn't want to live in that milieu. So I think it permanently soured me on going to New York, although I had many chances to go to New York and live, but I didn't want to.
Do you still feel the same way about broadcast news as you did when you made that speech?
Well, it's so different that I think the words of 35, 40 years ago probably are not quite applicable anymore, because the scene is so different from what it was. Back then, there were three networks, just three evening news broadcasts. But then in the late 70s and 80s came deregulation, cable instead of three channels. Now there are 500. So the criticism I laid down then was, I thought, fit then. I'm not sure it fits now.
And then came that day when, after you had resumed being the weekend anchor for Walter Cronkite and filling in for him, the time came when Walter Cronkite was eased out. He probably, do you think he would have liked to continue?
No question. No
he
question.
Would he, have
in
liked
fact,
to
he,
continue.
He told me that the last time I interviewed him, which was, 4 or 5 years ago.
But they eased him out because?
Because he had indicated that he wanted to retire at 65,
mm-hmm.
but he told me, he said, if I had known how good my health was going to be, I would not have asked for retirement. Anyway, it was pretty obvious that ABC was trying to hire Dan Rather away from CBS, and they didn't want to lose him. And I don't blame him, because he's such a fine reporter, Dan is. But they knew that the only thing that would keep him would be a piece of the evening news. So with the pressure on to keep Dan, and I imagine a nudge or two from the front office, Walter agreed to this retirement at age 65. Bill Leonard, who was then the president of CBS, thought he could kill two birds with one stone and offered a co-anchorship, Dan in New York, me in Washington. And I declined that because I didn't think it would be a good fit. And I said, no, I wouldn't want to do that. And so at that point, Leonard knew that that he would offer the whole show to Rather. And he did. And
but you didn't know about it until...
Well, I had... Dan played a very tough game with a very tough agent. He had a very aggressive agent, but I had an agent back then, and said, I don't want to do that. They know what I can do, and they know what my telephone number is, and if they want me, they'll call. Ha ha ha! So, again, being naive about how networks work. So I didn't play the game, and it became obvious that a big decision was in the offing, and I was in Washington, and got a call from New York that Mr. Leonard was coming down, and not to leave the bureau, that he would come down. He wanted a meeting. So
at first he said he wanted to have lunch with you,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
Secretary called and said he's running late, just going to drop in.
Yeah. Well, all that was, but the word had spread, but nobody had come to me and said, Rather's got it. I may be naive, but I'm not stupid. But I knew something. I knew in my heart that what was coming, but just nobody had told me. So Leonard finally arrived, and the secretary came and said, "Mr. Leonard is here, and he wants to see you up front." And I had to walk across the newsroom floor, and nobody said anything. Nobody looked at me. They all sort of looked away when I walked by, and went in, and he said, "We're going with Rather." And it was a very brief meeting, and I left the Bureau soon after and didn't come back for 26 years.
We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my 2008 conversation with Roger Mudd, all about his book, The Place to Be, Washington, CBS, and the Glory Days of Television News. And here's an email for Roger Mudd. He's the author of a brand new book. It's titled The Place to Be, Washington, CBS, and the Glory Days of Television News. This is from Robert, who says, "Roger, a friend of mine always tells the story that you saved his life. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Bill Wiesel of ABC News was also shot. He said no one was paying any attention to him, but you scooped him up and took him outside, where you took him to the hospital in a cab. I have seen his huge scar. You are quite a man. Best voice ever on TV."
Gosh, that's an interesting email. I have no memory of that.
Really?
Yeah. My memory of that night has basically been whited out for me.
Really, yeah, Roger? Yeah. You were there in that hotel, yeah, in that huge group of people surrounding Robert Kennedy.
The Ambassador Hotel, and just suddenly you heard shots, and just it was this maelstrom. And I remember seeing Ethel Kennedy there, not quite knowing what to do, and her whole body was shaking. And I went up to her and put an arm around her just to steady her, and she looked at me and, of course, knew who I was. And just behind us, somebody was saying something about Senator Kennedy, and she turned and said, "How dare you say my husband's name?" And he looked up and said, "Ma'am, I've been shot too." And then she suddenly realized, you know, what an awful moment it was for both of them, and she bent down and kissed him. And then the crowd around the senator on the floor was so solid locked that I had to pry people open so she could get into the circle. But then at that point, everything moved out toward the ambulance. And we had this death watch over at the Good Samaritan Hospital. And then CBS said, "You got to come to New York. We're doing an hour special the next night." And I got on the plane. And I had virtually no memory of what had happened. Remember on the airplane saying absolutely nothing to anybody. Not to the stewardess, not to my seatmate, not to the cab driver, landing and going into Manhattan, and unable to figure out why everybody was just going through a normal day. Didn't they know what I knew? But people were laughing and talking as they always did, and it was a day that I remember in such a sort of detached, disconnected way.
Let's take a caller in Long Island, New York. Good morning, Douglas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Mr. Mudd,
even though you were asked if you still agreed with the gist of the speech that you made at Washington Lee and didn't really give a yes or no answer, I have to say that I disagree with you that not necessarily television, but radio journalism is very important to me. I listen to NPR every day, a little bit of a news junkie, including Diane Rehm, and I get virtually all of my news from NPR and the BBC World Service. And I consider it a crucial resource for open-minded individuals, even though in the ensuing years since you made that speech at Washington and Lee, many, many more resources are available. I still get virtually all of my news from the radio. And one last comment is, even though you were drummed out of CBS through what it sounds like political circumstances, I feel that you went out in much better circumstances than Mr. Rather went out. Thank you very much.
Douglas, I think whatever caused my departure from CBS was not political. I would take exception to that. But I do agree with your criticism about that part of my speech not applying to radio. I wasn't talking about radio back then, and I agree with you about radio. It is the last best hope, I must say.
And, of course, you are a listener to public radio, are you not, Roger Mudd?
May I say that this interview is launches my book tour, and no book can be properly launched without being on National Public Radio with Diane Rehm.
Thank you, Roger. Here's an email from Jerry, who says, I remember Roger Mudd receiving two delegates' votes for vice president when he was covering a political convention. I'd like to hear him talk about covering political conventions in the days when the nominees were not decided beforehand.
That was the 72 convention, and it was this is the George McGovern convention. And if you remember, McGovern didn't finish his speech until 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, the acceptance speech. But in the nominating procedure for vice president, because these were a different kind of delegates in 72, they had opened up the process, and you had a lot of young people, and you had a lot of minorities, and so they were having fun, and everybody was being nominated for vice president. Everybody. And Wisconsin's name was called on the roll, and the chairman stood up and announced that 15 votes for Sergeant Shriver, 11 votes for Tom Eagleton, and two votes for Roger Mudd. And I was off the floor at the time, and Cronkite had me come out on the floor to do an interview, and I played it straight and said that I would have no comment, Walter, until I'd met with my farm policy advisors and we'd devised a plank and so forth. But I found out that they were two young women from Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, who were great fans of the Saturday News.
I love it. Roger, wasn't there a little bit of a rift between you and Cronkite early on because of a convention incident?
Well, in 1964, the Republican convention was in San Francisco. And by his own admission, it was not one of Walter's best performances. He did a lot of more talking than he should have, I guess, under those circumstances. I think he resented the presence of Eric Severide at the desk with him. And so he tended to be a mic hog. And we lost badly to NBC. We'd been losing badly through the late 50s and 60s. Bill Paley, the owner of president of CBS, got tired of being beaten by what we call the National Biscuit Company. And he unhorsed Cronkite and replaced him with Robert Trout, the radio man, and me. We did not do very well, Bob and I. And I think Cronkite naturally would have regarded me as an upstart who, occupied his throne temporarily. It was never any direct friction about it, but I think that was one in a list of things that served as irritants over the years.
You asked for an interview with Walter Cronkite for this book?
No, I did not.
Why not?
What? This book is about the Washington Bureau. I didn't interview Mike Wallace. I didn't interview the staff in New York. Walter was a major, major presence because he was a hard newsman, and he regarded the Washington Bureau as a really first-class operation, and he wanted reporters to report. He didn't want a lot of features. He wanted crisp copy, and that's what we gave him. But he was not part of the galaxy of men and women in the Bureau.
Roger, you won the Peabody Award for your 1979 special on Ted Kennedy. There was a very powerful and revealing moment in that interview, which probably derailed Ted Kennedy's aspirations for the presidency.
I'm not sure it was what derailed the campaign. It didn't help. As subsequent events proved, he probably had not prepared himself sufficiently for the campaign.
What happened during that interview?
Well, we did two interviews, one up at his home at the Cape and one in his office on the Hill. And I was asking him to tell me the difference in his position on certain issues with President Carter. And I kept thinking to myself, why would he want to unhorse a sitting Democratic president from his own party? And I thought that differences would have to be fairly sharp for him to embark on that campaign. So he began to answer, and I never saw much, a big difference between his position on inflation or energy and Carter's. So finally I said, why do you want to be president? And there was, must have been, I saw the film the other day, and there must have been a good 10 seconds before a word came out of his mouth. And the answer ran, I think, maybe 400 words, and we used most of them. And it was, someone said it was incoherent. It wasn't incoherent, but it didn't make a lot of sense. And the answer demonstrated that, in fact, he had not really prepared himself for that question, or prepared himself properly for the campaign. I think he felt, given the history of his family, I think he felt that he had ascended to the nomination without really having to work hard for it. And I think that was shown in subsequent campaign events.
And, of course, prior to that interview, you and the family of Bobby Kennedy had been quite close. With many invitations to Hickory Hill, the family home and the like, and that came to a complete halt, I gather.
It did, yes. I was a persona non grata after that. I must say, in the aftermath, I found that the senator became a very good senator, very hardworking, strong on the issues, and for a lot of Americans who don't feel properly represented by their senator, they identify with him as someone that they find admirable.
And finally, to West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Tom.
Thank you. I want to thank Eric Severide and all the reporters for CBS and you, Roger Mudd, especially the ones that report from Vietnam, because they saved my life. I can tell you I was on the verge of signing up with Marines in the late 60s. I came home and I saw a village get napalmed. And at that point, I knew that this war would not change the hearts and minds of these people with their water buffaloes and their little villages. And at that point, I started reading about the war and I changed from a hawk to a dove. Huh. And it's just a goddamn shame that this country has not learned that lesson. And we're doing the exact same thing in Iraq.
Well, that's a strong statement. I think I'll let it stand on its own, Tom, but thanks for the call.
What do you think about the reporting regarding Iraq? What's your view?
Well, I'm just a consumer, and so I'm not in the loop. And it's just I watch at night, and I watch as best I can. I think it's as good as it can be under the circumstances.
And the circumstances
just the difficulty of moving around the country, the difficulty of getting to the right people, to talk to the right people, and having to go against the grain from the opinions and statements and pronouncements that are made by the administration about the success, when on the ground it runs very counter to what the White House is saying. And that makes it very difficult for reporters to be put in the position of going against what the President of the United States says.
And of course, you, Roger Mudd, have throughout your career gone against the grain of superiors. I have to tell you, this is a wonderful book, and I do congratulate you, Roger. You are a dear friend, but also someone whose absolute honesty and integrity I have always appreciated. Thank you so much.
Being with you, Diane, has been a distinct pleasure, as always.
Thank you. That was my 2008 interview with my dear friend Roger Mudd, longtime correspondent, backup anchor for CBS News. He died earlier this month at age 93. He was a fine journalist. I will miss him. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.